Welcome to our third podcast in a series that explores that peculiar Western phenomenon called the orchestra. I'm Stephen Larson, music director of the Rockford Symphony, and I'm glad you joined me. Let's do a quick review of what we've covered so far. In the first podcast, we tried to determine exactly what an orchestra is. We examined what we know empirically about orchestras, looked at the words, the origin of the words orchestra and similar words like symphony and philharmonic. In podcast two, we tried a different tack, looking for clues in the music that orchestras perform. We discovered that orchestra programs almost never feature music written before 1680. That's the year that's considered to be the start of the late Baroque era. Didn't anybody write music for orchestra before 1680? Or were instrumental ensembles gradually evolving into what we would now call an orchestra? And if that was the case, how did it happen? This is what I'd like to consider in this podcast, number three. If you were still awake at the end of podcast two, you might remember that I promised I would talk about the different instrumental families in the orchestra, and as an enticement to listen, I would share some instrumentalist jokes. I beg your pardon, but I'm going to have to defer the jokes until podcast four. When I started sketching out ideas, I realized that there were a lot of other things to discuss before we started looking at today's orchestral instruments. So bear with me here. I'll try to make it worth your while. Here we go. 66 million years ago, the dinosaurs, as well as three-quarters of the Earth's animal and plant life, went extinct in a relatively short period of time. This has come to be known as the Cretaceous-Paleogene extinction event, and is the largest mass extinction ever to occur on this planet, so far at least. Most scientists believe that it was caused by an asteroid that crashed into the Earth near what is now the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico. Another mass extinction happened in the early 17th century, though on a much, much smaller scale. I call it the Renaissance instrument extinction. Musical instruments in the Renaissance were a strange and exotic collection of winds, brass, and string instruments. There were lutes of all sizes whose strings were plucked and strummed. Bowed string instruments, which included a family of viols that came in large, medium, and small, and instruments called viols and the lira da braccio. A whole family or consort of recorders existed. Sopranino, soprano, alto, tenor, bass, and contrabass. There were transverse flutes in different sizes. More exotic and less familiar to us today were the cornetos, zincs, and crumhorns. One of my favorites of this odd collection was the family of double reed instruments, the precursors to modern bassoons called rackets. The instrument's amusing enough, but even better was its nickname, the sausage bassoon. And let's not forget about sackbuts, brass instruments that looked like skinny trombones. The Renaissance was an age in which European cities were growing and craftsmen of all sorts were plying their trades. Instruments were handmade in small shops, often over a period of months. Northern Italy had the greatest concentration of string instrument makers in Europe, especially in the cities of Brescia, Mantua, and Cremona. These makers were called liutaio, meaning one who makes lutes. In English, a luthier. Somewhere in the early 1500s, luthiers in Brescia and Cremona tinkered with the design of the viol and the lira da braccio in such a way that a new instrument was created. They called it the violino, or violin. This experimental instrument, as it turned out, had legs, to use a modern phrase. Going back to my great extinction analogy, the violin and its larger siblings like the viola and the cello were like those little mammals that lived at the end of the Cretaceous period and after the demise of the dinosaurs evolved into the principal land animals on the planet. The violin, in less than a century, would be regarded as the world's most important musical instrument. By 1680, the beginning of the late Baroque era, most of those exotic Renaissance instruments had either disappeared forever or evolved into more familiar modern versions of their former selves. How did this happen? It wasn't caused by a meteor strike, volcanic eruption, earthquake, climate change, coronavirus, or any other natural disaster. I think it can be traced to a change in musical style between what we have come to call the Renaissance and the period we now call the Baroque. I think it can be traced to one Italian city, and I think it can be traced to the creation of a new musical genre that made demands on the old instruments that they could not deliver. The violin found itself literally in the right place at the right time. We experienced something like this more recently with the ascendancy of the guitar. In the early 20th century, small jazz bands became popular. The minimum requirement was a bass, drums, a solo instrument, and an instrument that could play harmony, like a piano or guitar. This grew into the big bands that were popular in the 30s and 40s. A typical big band had four trumpets, four trombones, four saxophones, string bass, drum set, piano, and guitar. Can you pick out the weak link in that array of powerhouses? Yep, the guitar. Without amplification, the guitar would become completely irrelevant, but the advancement of electronics that came with the rise of the radio industry led to the development of the electric guitar, giving it sonic parity with the other instruments. But the future of the electric guitar was not parity, it was dominance. Rock and roll made the electric guitar the most popular and most important instrument of the 20th century, the symbol of youth, independence, and the free spirit. Electric guitars were relatively inexpensive, very portable, easy to learn, at least on a basic level, and capable of filling any room from nightclub to sports arena with a wall of amplified sound. In only a few decades, the guitar had evolved from an instrument whose principal role was to fill in the harmony to the undisputed leader of the world's most successful musical genre, rock and roll, as well as the mainstay of rhythm and blues, country and western, soul, and many other genres. There's a reason that there's a national chain of music stores called Guitar World, and not one called Saxophone World. Let's go back to the 16th century and talk about music in the Renaissance. Music historians talk about eras, long periods of time in which we can observe some common features. The Renaissance in music is generally considered to have lasted from 1400 to 1600. Up to and including the Renaissance, the most important kind of music was vocal, music for the voice, not music for instruments. This may seem strange considering all the previous talk about all those Renaissance musical instruments that are about to disappear, but even though there was a lot of musical instrument performance in the late Renaissance, it was based on the styles, techniques, and forms of vocal music compositions. If you compare a Renaissance composition for instruments with one for voices, the only difference you might see is that the latter had words. The style of writing was the same, based on the human voice, especially the combination of several voices at the same time. When a Renaissance composer sat down to write, whether for voices or instruments, he started with a template of five independent musical lines. We can visualize it as something like soprano 1, soprano 2, alto, tenor, and bass. If you sang in a madrigal group in high school, you know exactly what I'm talking about. The voices were unified into a coherent whole through a complex system of rules and procedures called counterpoint. That word comes from the Latin phrase punctum contra punctum, or point against point, which was a visual description of how one of those notes on the paper, or points, had to be moved in relation to the other note. Counterpoint regulated the proper way to write a melodic line, what intervals were consonant, what intervals were dissonant, and how everything should be woven together to form a pleasing composition. We call this texture polyphony, coming from a Greek word which means having many voices. Polyphony and counterpoint, polyphonic and contrapuntal. The words are different, but they mean exactly the same thing. Instruments were often called on to reinforce the voices, or sometimes performed by themselves. This is why so many Renaissance instruments were made in consorts, or families that covered this vocal spectrum from soprano to bass. A piece originally written for voices could be played by a group of different sized recorders, or viols, or rackets, or sackbuts. Or you could mix and match different kinds of instruments just as long as the notes were covered. To a Renaissance composer, the particular sound or color of an instrument wasn't important. A part could be played by a plucked string, a bowed string, a woodwind instrument, or a brass instrument, or a combination. In general, composers assumed that whatever instruments were available at a performance would join in on the appropriate part. To sum up here, music in the late Renaissance was polyphonic, using a five-voice texture and based on vocal models. Do you hear that distant whirring noise? That's the sound of my music history professors spinning in their graves at this simplification. All right, it's a thumbnail sketch, and my thumbnails can only hold so much information. I could devote a few hundred hours to painting a complete and comprehensive picture, but it would still come down to the basic truth of that summary. Polyphonic, five-voice texture, instruments following vocal models. Keeping the end in sight, my goal is to explain how the orchestra came to be. In late 16th century Florence, a remarkable group of men would change the history of music. Not only did they change history, they willfully and consciously intended to change it. They didn't know it at the time, and probably never knew it, but one of the consequences of their plans was the creation of what we now call the orchestra. That this happened in Florence wasn't really a coincidence. It could only have happened in Florence at the time. Until it was sacked by the mutinous troops of Charles V in 1527, Rome had been the intellectual and artistic center of the Italian Renaissance. But the sack of Rome devastated and depopulated the city, and the artists and the humanists who survived fled north, largely to the Republic of Florence. Since the early 15th century, Florence had flourished under the rule of the Medicis, a powerful banking family and political dynasty whose influence spread throughout southern Europe. There were four Medici popes and two Medici queens of France. The Medicis were patrons of Leonardo da Vinci, Michelangelo, Machiavelli, and Galileo. They funded the construction of St. Peter's Basilica and were leaders of the Counter-Reformation movement against Protestantism. Towards the end of the 16th century, Florence's political and economic power were waning, but it was still an important center for music and intellectual discourse. In about 1570, a group of Florentine scholars, musicians, and poets began meeting regularly in the palace of a man named Giovanni de Bardi. Bardi was a duke who, despite being a career soldier, had enjoyed an excellent education in the classics. He was fluent in Latin and Greek and was an amateur poet and composer. This group of men, of course they were men. Women in Florence weren't allowed to be educated beyond the reading, writing, and arithmetic needed to run a household, along with just enough Latin to understand the Catholic Mass. This group of men wanted to use the lessons of classical Greek culture to revitalize music and drama in their own times. They were so self-aware of the importance of their work that they gave themselves a name, the Camerata dei Bardi, or in English, Bardi's Camerata. What's the English translation of Camerata? There isn't any, because they made it up. Since they met in a chamber in Bardi's palace, and the Italian word for room or chamber is camera, they invented a word that meant the people that meet in the chamber. Historians have decided to call them the Florentine Camerata. It has nothing to do with spinach. The Camerata members believed that music had become corrupted by too much emphasis on learned counterpoint, whose complex textures obscured the meaning of the words being sung. It probably wasn't a coincidence that only a few years earlier, for the very same reason, the Council of Trent formally denounced the use of complex polyphony in the Catholic Mass. In the minds of Camerata members, ancient Greek theater was the epitome of dramatic and musical expression, and they searched Greek literature for guidance in revitalizing music and drama in their own times. They didn't really know how the ancient Greeks used music in their theaters, but they inferred that at least the choruses and probably all of the dramatic roles must have been sung and danced. The members of the Camerata came to the conclusion that the most effective communication of text, and therefore its meaning and emotion, would be by one person at a time singing in such a way that was close to the rhythm and pace of speech. This speech song would be supported by harmonies played by lutes or keyboard instruments. They called this monodia, or monody, borrowing the word the Greeks used to describe the recitation or singing of lyric poetry. This style of writing became the defining characteristic of the music written by Florentine composers at the end of the 16th century. Polyphony would have no role in their music. Monody had its limitations, however. It was great for allowing the delivery of text clearly and understandably, but the closer it leaned to speech, the more difficult it became to achieve musical expression. Monody couldn't let beautiful melodies soar in flights of rapture. It couldn't bring two voices together to sing in sweet harmony, and it couldn't make feet move to the rhythm of dance. To make a bad pun, pure monody could get monotonous. There needed to be a balance, and this time the Camerata didn't have to invent anything. They just had to turn to the style that was the opposite of polyphony, a style that had been around for many centuries, a style well known to all because it was the essential element of popular and folk music everywhere, homophony. Homo for same, phony for sounding together. Homophony was the ages-old practice of combining a melody with a musical accompaniment, either harmonic, rhythmic, or both. In homophonic music, the listener's attention is drawn to a melody, usually in the highest part, which is accompanied by harmony and rhythm below. There was no need to mentally sort out four or five voices moving independently of one another as it was with polyphony. You could just follow the tune, and if you wished, tap your foot or sing along. If polyphony was haute cuisine, monody was the palate cleanser, and homophony was comfort food. Jacopo Peri was a composer and a member of the Camerata. In 1597, he wrote a musical drama that was intended to be the culmination of all their discussions and theorizing on how to emulate the achievements of ancient Greek theater. It was called Daphne, based on, of course, an ancient Greek myth. The story was told primarily through monody, with interpolations of homophonic dances and choruses. It was a new musical genre. It combined poetry, singing, acting, dance, and scenic design into one art form. It deserved its own name, and sometime in the next 50 years, we're not exactly sure when, it got it. Opera. Opera, as it was pronounced in Italian, means a work, meaning implying a synthesis of arts and disciplines. Daphne was the first opera, and it started a movement. The original Daphne is lost, but in 1600, Peri wrote his second opera, Eurydice, or Eurydice, which is credited as being the oldest existing opera. 1600 is also a nice round number that's easy to remember. Opera was a uniquely Italian art form, but in a few years, operas were being written and performed throughout northern Italy and, as a result of the Medici connection with the French monarchy, in France. By the early 18th century, opera was the most popular and influential musical genre in Europe, touching every aspect of music. Opera challenged composers' imaginations like never before. An opera told a story which had to be clearly presented. Each character had to be musically distinguished from other characters. How could dramatic actions be conveyed through musical analogs? How could the gamut of human emotions, joy, sorrow, anger, fear, hatred, grief, despair, be represented musically and made clear to audiences? Frankly, this was too much to ask of mere pitches, rhythms, and note values. Composers turned to the accompanying instruments for help. You can see that this only dawned on composers gradually because the earliest operas didn't identify instruments that were required. Whatever musicians were available could be used, kind of like a modern jam session. But experience soon taught them that some scenes called for specific instruments. In a pastoral scene, shepherds might require flutes. The entry of a god or king needed a trumpet fanfare. The excitement of a battle could be illustrated with loud drums. As musicians improvised from their written notes, new techniques were discovered, and the horizons of their instruments' capabilities expanded. Innovation was needed and welcomed. By 1600, the luthiers of Cremona, Brescia, and Mantua had been making violins, violas, and cellos for at least three generations, and hundreds of these instruments were being played across northern Italy. They produced a strong, assertive sound that far outshattered their older cousins, the viols, whose tone was, by comparison, thin and nasal and less capable of tonal variety. Increasingly, composers specified violins as the core instruments for an opera ensemble and exploited performance techniques that were constantly evolving. This is a good time to introduce to you Claudio Monteverdi, who I feel is the most important Italian composer of this age. He was born in 1567 in Cremona, and died in Venice in 1643 at the ripe old age of 76. His career nicely coincides with the end of the Renaissance and the early Baroque, and he is, in fact, the composer who most adeptly facilitated that transition. He didn't invent opera, but he raised it to a level of sophistication and expressiveness that influenced generations that came after him. His first opera, Orfeo, composed in 1607, has the distinction of being the oldest opera still in the repertory of the world's opera houses today. Two other works, The Return of Ulysses to His Country and The Coronation of Poppea, are also often revived. Just a personal aside here, the closing duet of Poppea, Pur ti miro, pur ti godo, is devastatingly beautiful and sounds remarkably modern. Check it out on YouTube. He was the first composer to specify in detail what instruments he wanted and to write for them idiomatically, exploiting the instrument's special abilities. More subtle, but just as important, was an innovation that he introduced that I'm sure nobody in his audience noticed at the time, a change that might even seem trivial. Remember when I said earlier that Renaissance music was mostly based on a five-voice texture? Monteverdi slimmed that down to four voices, what we can think of as being equivalent to soprano, alto, tenor, and bass. This produced a more transparent sound, which helped focus the audience's attention on the stage. The idea caught on, and other composers followed it. Now, the instruments of the violin family fit this four-voice texture like a hand in a glove. One or more violins played the top or soprano line. One or more violins played the alto line, and could also join the first violins when called for. One or more violas played tenor, and one or more cellos played the bass line, which was doubled an octave below by a contrabass instrument like the bass viol. A keyboard player followed the bass part and improvised harmonies to fill out the texture. This was the basic orchestra that our expert Neil Zaslaw had described in the second podcast. By 1680, the violin family was the undisputed core entity for which composers wrote. It was the orchestra. Flutes may come and oboes may go, but violins were forever. They had come through the Great Renaissance instrument extinction as the dominant instrument, a position they would hold until the 20th century. In the next podcast, we'll look in detail at the violins, but before we bid adieu to the viols, who by the end of the 17th century will have disappeared until the revival of early music performance in the 20th century, let's have a closer look at their family. Knowing something about them will help us better understand the violin. First, a double disambiguation. The musical instrument of which we speak is, in English, the viol, spelled V-I-O-L. It is pronounced exactly the same as V-I-A-L, a small glass container for holding liquids, and V-I-L-E, an adjective meaning disgusting or loathsome. This unfortunate triple homophone occurs only in English. In Italian, this instrument is called viola, exactly the same name as the middle instrument of the violin family. Before the invention of the violin, any bowed string instrument was called generically in Italian viola, the plural being viole. When viols first appeared in the 15th century, they were made in a variety of sizes from very high to very low, but eventually this became standardized into three versions, treble, tenor, and bass. At first glance, viols look like violins. They are made of wood and are of similar color. They have long necks for fingering strings that are stretched over a bridge and have similar looking bodies with symmetrical sound openings. Look a little closer though and you'll see that viols have six strings instead of four and their fingerboards have frets like a guitar. Also, the shoulders of the viols slope down rather steeply, whereas violins have rounded shoulders that mirror the curves at the bottom of the instrument. But the most dramatic difference comes when you see how viols are played, vertically, like a cello, with the instrument held between the knees, even the smaller instruments. This led to a convenient way of differentiating them from members of the violin family. A violin or viola, played either resting on the left arm or held under the chin, was called a viola da braccio, or arm viol. An instrument held between the knees was called a viola da gamba, or leg viol. Given time, language always moves towards brevity. Da braccio has disappeared from practical usage completely, and members of the viol family are now simply called gambas, or their players gambists. But we really don't have to concern ourselves about what to call viols today because most of you will never see one. But if you do see a gambas perform, notice how they hold their bows, underhand, the opposite of way violinists and cellists hold them. There are many other differences, but the most important one is the viol's tone, which is thinner and weaker than that of the violin. I know I disappointed you by making you wait for instrumentalist jokes until podcast four, so I thought I'd close this podcast by telling you a good viola da gamba joke. I can't find any. Sorry. They just aren't funny. Oh, one more little mystery that we left dangling from the first podcast and that I promised I'd answer. Remember that area in front of the Greek stage where the chorus sang and danced that was called the orchestra? How did that word change from describing a physical space to designating a group of musicians? In the Renaissance, the word orchestra was revived to label the area between the stage and the audience. In the early 17th century, the early Baroque, instrumentalists sometimes performed in that space, and sometimes on a platform to the side or the back of the stage. Any space in which musicians sat could be called the orchestra. Later in the 17th century, a bit of linguistic jujitsu took place, flipping the meaning of the word. People would speak of a musician playing in the orchestra, meaning playing in the space in which the orchestra sits. But that phrase could just as easily mean playing in a group of musicians. At the early 18th century, the word orchestra was clearly understood to mean a group of musicians and not the place they sat while playing. The old meaning of orchestra to describe a place in the theater never completely died away, though. Even today, the seats of a theater closest to the stage are called the orchestra. Well, to sum up, the invention of opera at the end of the Renaissance era brought great changes to musical performance. Polyphony faded into the background, homophony became the norm. Dramatic and expressive demands of opera forced composers to be more innovative in instrumentation. That and a thinning of the instrumental texture from five voices to four led to the standardization of the violin-based ensemble, which was the basis for the first orchestra. Viols disappeared, as did most of the instruments for which the Renaissance was known. By 1680, the beginning of the late Baroque, the violin family had become the most important instrument in Western music, the heart and soul of the orchestra. Thanks for listening. I'm Stephen Larson.